Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steel. And tonight we're going to do Manly Hall reading again, lecture, number 142. And this was 1971 that he delivered this lecture. And it was the experience of inner spiritual needs. Our own necessity leads us on. And I was kind of fascinated by this particular lecture. And because as we've been talking about the, in 2012 and the end of time and space and so on. And this kind of plays into this. It's best that I just begin. And I don't know if I'll be able to finish this whole one tonight. It's about a little long, but we will try. Of course, it's by Manly P. Hall. Not long ago, I was a bystander to a conversation in which several gather well-informed persons were attempting to interpret present world conditions. One suggests that we are experiencing a new expression of the Renaissance symbolism, and there was presently a rebirth or revival of a standard of life that had previously failed but now had to be revitalized by some elaborate critical change in human affairs. Another individual felt that present conditions more resembled the Protestant Reformation, in which the emphasis, of course, was largely religious, and it is true that a number of church problems are coming into focus today. Now, this was written in 1971, but yeah, it's right on the money again. Things haven't changed much in 39 years. A third person felt that perhaps world conditions reflected an age of revolution. In the 18th century, a number of European countries and the United States passed through a number of social changes in which the people cast off various authoritarian governments and demanded increasing liberties. Certainly, something resembling the era of revolution has developed in many countries, especially in Africa, the Near East, and practically all the former colonies of the European nations. And, of course, in 71, we were 68, 69, 70, 71, through 70, 73, through or 74, we were experiencing, the United States was experiencing somewhat of a revolutionary period. 73, the Nixon resigned, the first president ever resigned from office, and we're going through the period of change, and the Vietnam War. But actually, however, the Reformation did not touch the economic systems or the scientific or educational world to the degree that we are now experiencing. A third person felt that perhaps the world conditions reflected an age of revolution. In the 18th century, a number of European countries and the United States passed through a number of social changes in which the period people cast off various authoritarian governments demanding increasing liberties. Certainly something resembling the era of revolution has developed in many countries, especially in Africa, the Near East, and practically all the former colonies of the European nations. Actually, our various discussions were not very productive, except to the point out a hopeful indication that what is happening is really meaningful and will ultimately result in a general improvement in human society. No one happened to remember, however, the most interesting and remarkable parallel that we have to the present situation, and that is the great cycle of the penitents. During what we might term the Dark Ages in Europe, the devout reading very literally from Scripture and from the opinions of the early Church Fathers, described that the world was going to end about 1,000 years after the resurrection of Christ. The end of the world problem was one which produced perhaps the most startling and least understood cycles of hysteria that Europe ever passed through. Under the certain conviction that something extremely ominous, something cataclysmic, something inevitable was going to happen, persons of various nations, of every class and level of society, passed into a state of panic, political and psychological. In this panic, their first thought was apparently for a self-inventory. The individual and the group and for that matter, Europe as a collective, decided that it was not in any moral condition to face its maker. This resulted in a tremendous wave of penitential thinking. This was the age of the misericordia, the age of the flagellants, a time in which the earth of Europe was red with the blood of self-tortured and the dying. We do not know how many actually perished in the great cycle of penitence, but it probably exceeded a million and touched the lives of 20 times that number. It was a very important aspect of our history. Tied in it in as it was with certain natural disasters, earthquakes, pestilences, and unseasonal storms, the whole situation became completely uncontrollable. The prisons were open, and convicts joined the penitents. Some robbed the pious, and some died with the pious out of their own repentances. No one knew where he was going, but everyone was wandering. Mothers and newborn babes wandered through the snow of winter, and mothers and child died together. The cycle of penitence is hard for us to understand today, but it may be a little more understandable if we examine the psychology involved. In the days of the flagellants, the penitents and the pilgrims, so-called civilized man, was in a state of great emotional, spiritual fear. A crisis or panic, as we have called it. He was not afraid of death, primarily, because man cannot live in the presence of death from the moment he is born. Because man cannot live in the presence of death from the moment he is born to the moment it beckons to him, without becoming accustomed to its inevitability and to this inevitable. What medieval man was afraid of was himself. He was afraid of his own lack of integrities and afraid of his own sins. He was afraid of the vividly pictured afterlife as described by enthusiastic theologians. But most of all, he was afraid that his own immorality was threatened, not his mortality, but that his immortality was threatened, not his mortality. But his immortality, not his life in this world, but his place in the total existence of all the universe. He found himself searching his own nature and finding real or imaginary sins of enormous magnitude. Naturally, the essentially good found in themselves the larger sins, and the essentially evil found only small sins within themselves because of the gradual deformity of their consciences. But always there was something the individual regretted. If all else failed, he could remember the good words that he was born in sin and conceived in iniquity, and this was enough to start a new wave of spiritual uncertainty. The parallel to our time, perhaps, lies in the fact that we are under the same general fear as the fear of the Second Advent. Men of the 10th and 11th centuries believed that God was coming with fire and brimstone. The heavens would be shaken, the earth would be moved, and the pits of hell would be open. He had a very vivid idea of what was going to happen, and down in the subconscious of ourselves, some of this old fear is coming back. If you ask the average individual what he thinks of the world, what he thinks the world is going to be like 100 years from now, you'll be given a number of rather pessimistic options on the subject. For the first time in the development of modern man, certainly in the development of educated, cultured, modern peoples, a great fear is taking over, and it is a fear that is involved with destruction. This fear, no longer bound by a theological pattern, seems to rise particularly in our time from the level of scientific thinking. We are all facing three extremely difficult abstract situations. We have a much larger understanding of the possibilities that our ancient forebears, but this new understanding has not been especially reassuring. We are in the presence of a continuing and probably doomed to continue threat of nuclear armament. For the first time, man envisions a situation in which he can obliterate himself. This is just about as dismal a prospect for us as the opening of the gates of hell was in the 10th and 11th centuries. The second problem that concerns us is the population explosion, the problem of handling the inevitable increasing density of human population. And the third problem, of course, is the population problem. The latter is partly related to the population density and partly related to the development of nuclear armament. The problem today is that man must have water, air, and earth that are not polluted, and it is becoming more and more difficult to find these things. So the individual in his own subconscious perhaps is saying to himself, if conditions continue as they are, and individuals continue to live as they do, there might be a very major and dramatic crisis to human civilization, something we do not really want to look for. Now, this, of course, is our source of psychological panic, and it is, in many respects, quite similar to that of the penitents of previous ages. They expected the world to perish because of the punishment of God for the sins of men. By the way, just what do we think the present situation is caused by? Do we also feel some qualms of conscience? Is it gradually dawning upon us that most of our problems are due to one thing and one thing only, human selfishness? Actually, we could have a very pleasant world, which would be able to maintain itself for an indefinite length of time, were it not for individuals and nations taking this highly competitive attitude, which is the ruination of modern relationships. In any event, we are worried. And we are to a large measure frightened. But apparently our anxieties have had some of the edge taken off by a whole series of factors that the penitents of the Middle Ages knew nothing about or never gave any consideration. Their fear was good and honest, simple, inevitable, and direct because they were simply convinced that the time had come for Christ to return and judge the quick and the dead. He would divide the good and the bad, and very few persons did not have suspicions of being found on the not-so-attractive side. So things looked dismal, and each person in his own heart knew why. The prince and the pauper both realized their shortcomings, and in these great sessions of penitence, there were kings and princes, queens and empresses. No one was immune from the feeling of guilt. Looking at the situation as we see it today, we realize that a condition is gradually building up in which the guilt factor is becoming increasingly important in our social thinking. We are also being forced to divide man into two large collective structures, one group consisting of those striving sincerely and honestly to solve things, and the other group determined to destroy as much as possible. The latter is an energizing force, seems to be the hysteria in themselves, which compels them to reduce or destroy all existing structures and institutions. In this situation, we naturally begin to wonder how it all came about, and I think we are right back where we have always been, and where a great many people are beginning to realize that we are, and that is in the presence of a crisis in universal procedure. We are facing a situation in which our own indifference to the laws of nature is largely responsible to our trouble. Likewise, our indifference to the laws of society has resulted in the development of nuclear stockpiles, and our indifference to social proprieties has contributed largely to our population explosion. And of course, our total indifference to the well-being of our neighbor has led to the pollution problem. All these problems arise from our failure to recognize that Cicero stated so well long ago, a civilization is a condition in which people live together in harmony and mutual cooperation. And without cooperation, there can be no civilization, regardless of any other cultural advancement. So we are living in a world of competition, and we are beginning to reap the harvest of it. We have tried to live as we please in a universe in which there are no rules, and we have broken the rules. It is not necessary for us to have a highly emotional repentance in this case. This is not the real answer. A certain recognition, however, of our faults and a resolute determination to correct them is necessary. Nature says, either find your faults yourself or take the consequences. There are no compromises in the functions of natural law, and the individual cannot almost break a law or almost not break it. He is either on the side of the universe or he is on the side of trouble, and usually we are determined to go on to the last possible moment without making any constructive changes in ourselves. We have a mysterious hope, or we have a complete discouragement, and most persons wish that they will find solutions not particularly involved with self-improvement. Another group feels that it is too late, and the individual might as well be happy while he can. It seems to us that both of these answers are erroneous. Nature has no intention of allowing any individual to escape from the process of growing, not even by the process of dying. Nature is going to keep right on, and both the living and the dead must learn the law and keep it. There is no escape from the fact that when we do things badly, we build up a composite result that will return to us. Actually, therefore, behind all of these processes is a tremendous object lesson, and that lesson is whatever we have done which has caused the present difficulties must be undone. This is an inevitable conclusion. Whatever we have failed to do, that we must do. Instead of the belief of the Middle Ages, in which it was felt that deity was going to appear with a pair of scales to weigh souls, we have a new concept, but it is not essentially different in principle. Now the problem is that the world, the universe, the elements of nature, earth, fire, air, and water, stand as witnesses against us. They witness our abuse and our misuse, and our fellow men rise and witness against us. Every element, every natural resource used in questionable gain, and the millions of animals slaughtered for sport alone rise against us. Nature will not permit the individual to go on millennium after millennium making the same mistakes. After a certain length of time, and here nature is extraordinarily generous, we must face the consequences of all our actions, and the more mistakes, the more miseries. So it's basically eternal karma, folks, and that's what he's talking about. Therefore, what we are really facing is not a dismal and despairing situation. It is, in fact, the greatest invitation that man has ever received to do more straight thinking. Nature's invitations, however, can be a bit militant, and when nature invites in a case like this, it expects attention and results. If it fails in its intentions, which are subservient to plan, it presses its point more directly. But in any case, we cannot hope to maintain any progress for the human race unless the individual and the collective show more maturity. There must be a growing up of human purposes. We have been a long time getting into our present difficulties, and we may be quite a while getting out of them, But only when we start doing those things necessary to cure our difficulties will we begin to extract ourselves from causes which we set in motion. Then gradually, we can come to a better world, better because we have made it better. Motion against a better world continues in the fact that, in a large measure at least, authority still rests in those who believe that they can bluff their way through, or with those who are already so completely discouraged that they are not willing to try. Too much leadership is in the hands of the individuals who do not realize that all men are servants of natural law. Leaders in their various fields should be the first to set a good example of obedience to those principles which no living thing can reject with impunity. If we cannot depend upon the leadership of those who have entrenched attitudes, then it becomes necessary for us to achieve a leadership in ourselves. That's so very true. Our congressmen, our leaders, our presidents, our corporate leaders, they don't have a spiritual consciousness. That's why we have the problems we have now. We know that nature is a very highly discriminating power. The old scriptural idea is not very far from the truth. Nature can go through 10,000 sinners and punish them, yet if among them there is one virtuous man, he will be justly rewarded. Nature does not destroy the good with the bad. Nature finally destroys nothing. It transforms from the lesser to the potential of something greater. So the individual is still in the position where he must make his peace with the universe in which he lives. Excuse me. To find this peace and to find a way to realize it is the great spiritual need of our time, and it is the crisis itself which is creating the sense of need. There is probably more sincere, useful thinking at the moment than there has been for many, many years. Up to recently, we were so obsessed with a sense of our own inevitable progress and so proud of our various institutions that we never questioned their integrity. We never tried to find whether they were going anywhere or not. As long as they were moving, we were happy. This situation is changing, but it is very difficult for the individual to support this change. A certain part of the general hysteria is flowing into his personal affairs. He has more and more difficult situations to face, and he is looking for some kind of standard by means of which he can make decisions that are in a way useful to himself and others. In this moment, then, let us depend upon nature as a means of determining part, at least of our own code. Let us say to ourselves, when trying to make a decision, what would nature do if confronted with the same situation? Nature would have one option, however, that we do not have, and that is the availability of the inevitable integrity of its own purposes. This we are not sure of. Nature also knows that in the long run, every atom vibrating on its own axis must finally obey. Therefore, nature has a strength of enforcement which is not available to the average person. But there is one thing which nature can show us, and will show us if we are willing to be reasonably observant. Nature is honest. Nature has no place in its structure for subterfuge of any kind. Nature has no ulterior motives and will not tolerate any. Any condition that exists which is painful is due to some variation from the natural order of things. Thus we have evidences of what can be done and evidences of what cannot be done. Out of these, we must try to build our own code, building it as nearly as we can to the truths of life, and not allowing it to be hopelessly deluded and distorted by our own personal attitudes and pressures. The more the individual becomes pressure-ridden, the less reliable he is. The more he becomes involved in anxieties, the less honest he is likely to be. Therefore, he has to have some solid pattern to work from. And the only pattern that we know of is the pattern of natural process itself. This natural process, accepted into the consciousness, hearts, and minds of our forebears, gave us what might be termed a natural religion. These processes were the basis of those commandments which seemed to be written by the finger of God upon rock, earth, and tablets of gold. These principles, out of long living, have demonstrated themselves. They are not man-fashioned. They are not part of any institution that man has set up. They are not part of a mortal establishment, but they are part of a more immortal purpose, which man can like or dislike, obey or disobey, accept or deny, but his life will be measured by whether or not he keeps the rules. He cannot change them. Never can he change anything but himself. And our job is to bring our lives into harmony and these rules. With these rules, rather. One thing we can also learn is that there are many definitions of love. Perhaps natural love, as found in natural law, is the most important for us to recognize. Nature has an extraordinary tenderness and care for those creatures which it has fashioned. It gives them rules according to their insights. To man, some of these rules do not appear kindly or benevolent, but they are part of the great problem of keeping a balance in life. And nature's ideas of maintaining a balance in life is that growth shall be the result of the challenge for survival. Nature will not permit any form of life to settle down and enjoy itself. Nature demands that all happiness that comes to living things must come in the process of growing. Excuse me. And the being or creature does not know in consciousness, its happiness will gradually disintegrate into misery. So the problem the human being has to face is not what is comfortable or what is pleasant or what he can do to have more than his neighbor. The real problem is how should he live his own life so that he will mature? How can he use every day as nature intended him to use it as a means of becoming a more significant creature? Every day, a weakness must be outgrown or overcome. Every day, some form of ignorance must be transmuted into insight or understanding. And every day, something good must be accomplished, or gradually, that which is not good will corrupt us. And I think that's a critical aspect too. Excuse me, what we're even dealing with tonight. Excuse me. I found these to be fascinating. I wanted to share them with my listeners. And so doing, I guess I feel like in some way I'm probably following this natural order of things, that where I'm doing something, I feel something that's good for humanity, but also myself. I mean, I'm learning, and I try to learn something every day, whether it's something about myself or something about some other knowledge. You can probably tell I'm an avid reader, but I often find that I learn things as I experience them. I learn them in different ways, and I gain a greater appreciation for them. And if I can find myself appreciating something more every day, either about myself or about other people or about society or nature or whatever, maybe God, I feel like the day wasn't wasted, You know, I feel like the day was, I accomplished something during the day, something important to my own progress, and hopefully to others. So each person has the right to settle down and think about the creation of an important pattern for himself. This pattern must be completely honest, and it must be the kind of honesty that is part of a vast cooperative project. Honest people can cooperate, dishonest people cannot. Virtuous people can form lasting relationships, but in all these relationships, thieves fall out. The individual who has integrities can share them with others who possess them also. But those loaded with opinions, biases, and prejudices will fight their way through until some mortal wound drops them. There is no answer other than this. So we start by trying to understand natural law and natural love. We discover that nature long ago totally rejected the spoilage system. Nature rejected also any process which could encourage or perpetuate weakness. That which is essentially weak, nature weeds out. Weakness produces and perpetuates itself. Nature does not want to produce spoiled creatures who cannot work, cannot think, and cannot live. So as evolving persons, we cannot afford weaknesses of moral character either. We cannot afford to encourage, support, sustain, or defend weaknesses in others or in ourselves. Our purposes are not to make life softer. Our purpose is to make life more meaningful. We are in a time when only a little Spartan thinking will do any good, yet still we are largely dominated by our ambitions, our desires, and by our indulgences. And we do not rejoice at the thought of beginning to live a life under natural discipline. Natural discipline also has as its primary purpose not accumulation, but the actual advancement of consciousness itself. Consciousness is in man is a potential far greater than any natural resource that we can possibly imagine. Man's consciousness, however, is not at this time fully manifesting, and according to most systems of thinking, it is not fully developed. It is eternally wise in itself. It is nevertheless linked with our mortal nature, which is inadequate. Whatever may be the answer we have within ourselves, we have within ourselves a consciousness capable of a much more valuable contribution to our total being than is now apparently possible. Therefore, nature's primary concern with man is to develop that insight capable of sustaining leadership from within, which distinguishes man from lesser creatures. In man, natural law abides in his own consciousness. He must grow according to it and must live by it. If he does not, he is not going to succeed in maintaining the cultures which he has built. As we look around us, we see more and more evidence that the individual has been weakened by various habits, various convictions that are not essentially true or right. He is completely strong in his interpretation of why man is here. Man is not here to become the builder of empires. Man is not here to devote his resources, his time and his energy to this terrific competition for temporal advantage. Yet this is the principal activity of the human being. Nature says that this is wrong and proves it in several ways. One way is causing the individual who is bound by his ambitions to lose everything, including the love and respect of his family, the affections and regard of his children, respect of his friends, and even his own health, probably leaving this world by a coronary in his 50s. This is man's reward for doing things badly. Yet as a calculated risk, there are millions willing to follow this path today, inasmuch as success has yet been identified. This quest for success is habit forming. The withdrawal symptoms are so painful that we do not even attempt to a cure, and the only withdrawal we get is that with the narcotic addicted receives an early death. So he's saying that we can't pull out of this. We seem that we can't pull out of this existence unless we turn ourselves around. Another very serious weakness of man is his enormous waste of energy. This waste of personal energy is like the waste of natural resources. Without the most stringent laws, we would soon be a planet without a tree, and without equally stringent laws, we would exhaust every single natural resource that we have. Within a century, simply because we do not think and we do not care, nature says start to think and begin to care or else. And nature is right. Nature really has our good, our eternal good in mind. Doing the things that we want is not doing the things which are necessary. Man has enormous energy, energy to use constructively. Up to now, he has abused a great part of his energy. Every grudge, every malicious thought, every jealousy is an abuse of energy. And everyone who hates or is jealous or maintains unpleasant attitudes or schemes against his neighbor is going to bring down upon himself the inevitable retribution of natural law. It will strike him in his body and in his mind with the psychosomatic problems. The individual who feels sorry for himself all the time ends up as a neurotic, and this is nature's way. Man trying to defeat nature has created all kinds of remedies for conditions originating in his own attitudes. He will do anything but correct his attitudes. He is willing to spend $10,000 on analysis rather than a few hundred hours on self-education. He is willing to take enough pills and tranquilizers to kill a herd of elephants rather than change his own thinking by any effort of his own. He has become so inwardly enervated that he does not feel that he has the courage, the strength, or the stamina to do anything except fulfill the negative impulses that arise in him. Nature says that this has gone far enough. In fact, it is a little too far already. The hours of grace and repentance have more or less passed. The individual is now confronted with what he should have faced years ago in his present life, with that with what society should have faced centuries ago in its collective existence. We have been so hopeful that all these things would be overlooked or ignored that we did not see the necessity of dealing with them honestly. Then we found a little solace in that idea that perhaps there wasn't any God, there wasn't any natural law, and the individual could do what he pleased regardless. This lasted just long enough to find out that it was not true, and instead of solving anything, it participated in the present emergency more rapidly, as the universe does not care what we think about it. It does not care whether we believe in it or not. As Lord Bacon said, it has given us an edict, keep the rules and live, break the rules and die. And this is regardless of any philosophy, any attitude, or any group of individuals who work out the new philosophy. And if we do not use the proper means, or rather the new philosophy in their kitchens, these things do not mean anything. Nature continues. And if we do not use the proper means, the consequences will still be according to our conduct. All we have to do is relax our laws just a tiny bit regarding the harbors of this nation, and we would have bubonic plague in 60 days, regardless of what anybody thinks about it. And if we lose our tempers often enough, we will have our strokes and coronaries, regardless of all the philosophies philosophizing we can do on the subject. We either behave or we suffer. We can take this right into our personal lives, and to a measure we can try to use this realization in relationship to other people over whom we have spheres of influence. Our primary responsibility to others is to help them to grow, to help them to be strong, to help them to do right, even when it hurts. Let us help build better philosophies of life. Our problem is to advance their self-responsibility. And any one of our problems today is that too many parents have forgotten this and have taken it for granted and love between indulgence. And love, rather, means indulgence. Finally, the children have taken up this definition and say, if you love me, indulge me. These are certainly parent-present attitudes. And as a result, you can see the consequences. But nature moves along. Her final answer is to make the wrong thing unendurable. As long as we are willing to suffer for our mistakes, we will be given the grand opportunity. If we are perfectly willing to have headaches as the result of causing them, nature will finally bestow on us the greatest headache in history. If we do not mind ruining digestion, we can eat what causes indigestion. If we do not mind having bad government, we can keep on causing it. Whatever we do not mind suffering, we can indulge. But ultimately, we discover that suffering does not just remain a stomachache or headache. The longer we break these rules, the more chronic the ailments become. And gradually, the stomachache becomes ulcers or cancer. Gradually, the headache can become a tumor. Keep up the ailment long enough, and illnesses which could have been cured the moment the symptoms first appeared become incurable. So by keeping up our incurable mistake, we bring on incurable consequences. Ultimately, we can tear down the labors of lifetimes and the works of whole generations of conscious. And not conscious people. So we can say now that the search. And we are all trying to find the way of achieving, is the solution for the necessary energies and powers which have to be cultivated. We are now at a point where only the development of consciousness and the victory of consciousness over conditions can solve our problems. It is too bad to find a whole civilization so ill-equipped for this job. But of course the fact that we are so ill-equipped is simply the reason why we are in our present situation. If we had done any better anywhere along the line, we wouldn't be where we are now. So while we do not have the background for immediate solutions, we do realize that we must begin to build them. For the individual, it is always the same problem. He must achieve the victory of internal principles within himself. Consciousness must take over the administration of his affairs. And consciousness, in this sense, we simply interpret to mean the basic integrity behind man's conscious functions and the basic awareness of need. It is the basic use of faculties to solve problems. It is the basic use of emotions to dramatize the right and the dramatization, more or less, of the entire life of the individual is a form of dedication to the greater good of his own life, and the greater good of his brother's life, and the greater glory of the divine plan. So a person can begin to think things through. One way in which he can usually get a little idea of what to do is to listen to ourselves when we are advising someone else. We will then discover that we are giving some excellent advice which it would pay us to apply to ourselves. One parent can tell another to be strict with their child, but he will not be strict with his own, because he does not realize or sense in his own case that integrity is worth the cost the application of the integrity until will cause, with the consequence that the spoiled child will resent honesty. But that child must either face his deficiency or perish. And the one who does not, the problem of honesty becomes, in adult life, the habitual criminal. We cannot indulge a weakness in ourselves or others. We can be kindly and sympathetic, but always we must try to find out nature's way and inspire many people who can follow it, to follow it also. Nature's way for the average person today is nothing but the simple rule that we find in the Ten Commandments, the Sermon on the Mount, and in the teachings of practically all of the great world leaders. Begin to live a life based upon survival rather than being based upon destruction. If he must change it, and in the changing it, he will find that every constructive change that he makes is not a loss to him, but an improvement. He will find that the tremendous complexity with which he surrounds his life today is a misery and not a reward. The individual, by living poorly, is punishing himself from morning to night and from birth to death. Why should he continue this procedure when, with a little courage and a little insight and a little sense of responsibility, he can make life safer for others and far happier for himself than he has hitherto realized? And happiness does not come from destroying. It comes from fulfilling natural purpose. It comes from the truly being good gardeners in the eternal garden of life. And the alchemists have exactly the same attitude. Man's art perfects nature. And when man uses his wisdom to assist nature in the presentation of her purposes, the individual is wise, and nature bestows on him her bounty. In the search for value, we also have the problem, more or less, of two worlds in which to function. The individual has very largely bound himself to the world of external forces and pressures. He also has an internal world of resource, which for the most part remains undeveloped. He has not built a bridge between the objective and the subjective in himself. The only actual thing that passes across is the storm, which is able to bridge the interval. But this is not an adequate bridging. The individual has no internal life. The individual has no internal life, could find little satisfaction in it if it were to possess it, which is the reason why he does not. And when he sits down quietly with himself, he finds only a vacuum and loneliness. He is not equipped for any type of internal life. For this reason, he rushes dismally to the extreme one. He is trying to build a satisfactory existence in a military state of things, which is in a constant state of flux and change, and which has never been a satisfactory place since the beginning. It has not gotten better with time because man has not done anything to make it better. Actually, therefore, we take a great deal of pressure off the world when we begin to develop inner resources. When we no longer depend on the world to do everything for us, we begin to escape from the tyranny of worldly processes and emit from the idea that worldly gratifications are the only source of pleasure. Now, there are persons on every level of society who are already learning, who have already learned the truth, but they are not sufficiently numerous. There are a great number of individuals who live beautiful lives, almost independent of society. Certainly, they have to make a payment to nature for the essentials of life, and those who try to avoid this responsibility are acquire other problems as bad as those they are escaping. But many do maintain themselves in an honorable relationship with society. They have built a strong physical existence. How can possibly be stolen? These persons have, and without involvement in the tremendous process of our cosmic complex, form what we are suffering today. Actually, we all have some kind of inner life. The problem is to transform this ulterior from a kind of live inner garden, kind of desert, into a beautiful garden. If you have an inner garden, you can live in it. And every individual should have a garden in the center of his house. It is this garden in the house that makes the home. It is the garden of beauty in the life of man, and begins to encompass the right decision in daily contact. The person has got to build with meditation and visualization his own inner life, a garden in which to live, a place to value. Now this garden, however, must not be a neurotic escape. The individual must not run away from life to enjoy solitude under a tree. This is not the solution to anything. The solution to the whole problem is to be able to live in a fuller awareness of the condition of life, but to take the great existence of which we are a part. With all the time for all its apparent problems and difficulties, they recognize the work of a universal purpose. We have got to put the world in order, and this is only one simple move. The realization is that the world is in order. And the world is in order because we have got to put the world in order, and this is only one simple move. The realization that the world is in order. The world is in order, has always been in order, because order in this case means the natural operation of cause and effect. If we had now the things we want without... read this again. If we want without having to earn them, in the form of world peace and the like, then the world would be without order. Because we have caused these things, the world would be without order. We have not caused these conditions to exist, and we would not have earned them or have the right to them. We would not justify our ability to use them. We are asking, like small children, for the moon and the stars, and will not receive them this way. But the universe is in order, and the proof of this is the fact that the universe goes quietly on its way, never bringing true happiness to anyone who does not deserve it. Now, this is a very helpful series of thoughts if we want to continue with them. But thoughts do not cause us to do anything unpleasant. These thoughts do not cause us to be cruel to our neighbor. They do not cause us to do anything unpleasant, and certainly they do not cause us to feel superior to anyone else. The only thing they do is to take away from us this process that man has so long practiced of shaking his fist at heaven. Forever, it ends the problem as to the relationship of the invisible to the visible, of principles to their consequences, and the individual having sensed a just world and being inclined by nature to be just, or realizing that by not being just, he is most injuring himself. I don't know how many pages left I have here. A few too many to go on. I have about 5 more minutes. I'll try to continue this. Fatigue is a consequence of emotional pressure. It does nothing to help except help that which we do not want. Settling down free from this type of pressure, the individual can concentrate his attention upon trying to do the things nature wants him to do. He can begin to appreciate that the universe expects of him and requires of him, and he can begin his partnership with life and law, rather than trying to create some kind of insubstantial relationship with other people. So we have the same friends, we have everything we had before, but we gradually develop an inner sense of value. We do not have to go out and talk about it. We do not have to desperately try to convert people to it who does not want it, and all we have to do is live it. But if anyone else talks us out of living it, then it is our fault, because we must know better. And while we do not have the right to force change upon anyone, no one else has the right to force change upon us. Therefore, if we cannot help someone, we have no right to let them hurt us. We have to stand firmly for the principles that we believe to be solutional. Now, these solutional principles have many different applications. The world goes on its way, and we are going along with it. It is quite possible that society will outlive us. We hope that it will outlive the ages, but regardless of that, of what happened, every moment of the day and night, a human soul is leaving this world for something else, somewhere else. And at the same moment, a human soul is coming into the world from somewhere else. There is a continual motion of life, and the main concern that we all have to face is the importance of making our own peace with life. The individual who does not believe that this thinking is going to influence others is mistaken. He must also try to decide how much he is influencing himself for better or worse by his own thoughts. For while he has worked to make this adjustment, and he has finally sided with natural law, and has made his partnership with it, and has dedicated his life to living according to principles to the best of his ability, he has also achieved a victory. He has achieved an important fact, that is the growth of consciousness and integrity. This individual can face death with courage. He can take with him, when he leaves this world, that which he is, and that is that he is solutional. What he is enables him to face the future, not with fear, but with security and confidence. Even at the beginning, it permits him to pass out of this life with an available, pass out of this life with a greater sense of value and more substantial faith and hope than is available to the individual who has not made this adjustment. A person can live with himself and is capable of making all the transitions of life with itself, and not so better. It can do so better if he has enabled or has already established a sense of integrity in his own consciousness. And I'm going to leave it at that right now, and we'll try to pick it up again possibly next week. But I want to thank everyone who's listened and joined us, Thundercracker and a few others. Thank you, and I wish you all a good night. And please join us tomorrow when we have George Dixon with us, and we'll be talking again about some of the possibly fractal consciousness and quantum physics, and try to understand what's about to happen in 2012 as we all become whatever we become at that time. So I thank you very much and wish you a pleasant evening. Good night.